Tom Athanasio founded the organization Eco Equity, now affiliated with the Earth Island Institute. Eco Equity's mission is to demonstrate that success at reducing climate change to manageable levels, that is, saving the planet, it will require international cooperation. In particular, the industrialized countries of the West, they've emitted the bulk of greenhouse gases for the last 50 years and have created the crisis, the current crisis. They must send funds and transfer technologies to enable poor and developing countries like India, South Africa, Brazil, Indonesia, the Philippines, among others, and also, in fact, China and Russia, and, of course, all the island and low-lying nations. They have to reconstruct their economies. Some call the grants reparations to reimburse them for the damage that we've caused. They are now a very hard sell here, even though it is necessary to save our own lives and future. Tom Athanasio, Eco Equity, he went to the recent big UN conference on climate change, supporting the resource and funds transfer sought and demanded by the many countries with few resources that are suffering right now from climate change. The demand didn't do very well, but you're still optimistic, staying in the struggle. Tom, give us your analysis of the Glasgow conference.
I wouldn't actually say I was optimistic. I would say that I think there's a chance that the climate negotiations could actually deliver their part of the transformation that is going to be necessary to save our bacon. The negotiations were never going to save us by themselves, but it's very easy for people who are in despair to latch on to the negotiations and attack the negotiations as blah, blah, blah. And they are in many ways blah, blah, blah. But they're nonetheless making slow but steady progress. Whether or not society as a whole starts moving a lot more quickly is going to depend on a whole lot more than just the climate negotiations.
Tell us about some of the areas where you thought that it advanced the possibilities.
Right. So a million things have to happen to stabilize the climate system. But there were some key pieces that had to be moved at Glasgow. And there were three of them, really. One was finance, one was ambition, and the third one was loss and damage. Let's take the second one. The national pledges are just too weak. Now, I don't know if you want to call it kick in the can, but it has been decided that the countries are going to resubmit their pledges next December, as opposed to waiting till 2025. And there's a lot of pressure on countries to do that. Now, whether or not the big rich countries of the North are going to take the lead, as they must, and radically increase their ambition, that's an open question. And given the fact that right-wing authoritarians got so much political power right now, there's no particular reason to be optimistic about that. But nevertheless, there's going to be a new cycle of pledging next year. And if finance was available in a new way, that pledging could, you know, surprise us with its ambition. The finance question is really the keystone in terms of getting off the dime and getting things moving at the international level. And obviously, that's tied in with all kinds of really, really fundamental questions about where the money is and why the rich have so much of it and what we're going to do about transferring resources between the rich world and the developing world, the huge questions. The good news is that this issue is really on the agenda now in a way that it wasn't before. You know, 10 years ago, people were telling each other just so stories about how people were going to wake up and start massively transforming the world to no carbon and low carbon energy systems. No one's telling those stories anymore. Everybody knows that it's going to cost money and that it's going to involve cooperation. And we don't know. We don't know how things are going to play out. We don't know if the elites are going to get their heads together and start making some big moves, maybe at the International Monetary Fund, maybe at the World Bank, maybe with respect to, you know, an international taxation system hidden within the climate regime. There's all sorts of things that can be done, but it's on the agenda. And that's a big deal, Bill, because we're coming off of the Trump presidency, we're coming off of the pandemic, and it's 6 years since the Paris breakthrough occurred. If something big doesn't happen in the next year to give people some sense of motion, some sense that there are some adults in the room, people are going to get even more despairing than they already are.
You know, those same questions that you raised about international finance, it's also relevant for the United States as wealth concentrates and refuses to, in fact, pay taxes, and the state gets strapped and we spend so much money on the military.
No, you're absolutely right. It's the same story. I mean, let's be just real about this. If the right wing remains in power, not just in the United States, but everywhere else that it's managed to seize some significant fraction of power, we're not going to mobilize it at the level that mobilization is necessary. It's just not going to happen. The stakes are very high.
Yeah, until the crisis becomes so severe and they're blamed for it, and of course we have to attribute the problems to them right now, my sense is that our best chance of survival in a relatively modern civilization, our best chance for survival is when the crisis gets severe, that there's a Pearl Harbor period and the people rise up and say we have to take action and we have to make the kind of mobilization that we did in World War II, which meant taking over many factories and having a demand economy and rationing goods, and people cooperated. Tom, I read a number of analyses that were, they saw the proceedings and the final declaration as dominated by corporate interests who were pushing their own corporate plan for dealing with climate change that let them just keep producing and selling as always and keep polluting, but that they argue that we can force greenhouse emissions to go down because we enact carbon taxes, or we allow these phony offsets where they buy a forest and keep it uncut and then count all the carbon this forest captured, immensely, of course, exaggerating it. And that would then set off their own emissions so that they declare themselves carbon zero, company having no emissions. Actually, they're just flooding the universe with them. They talk about market-driven research into carbon capture. Huge amounts of money already spent on that technology, and it's failed, but it's continuing, the U.S. Department of Energy, and alternative fuels and safe nukes and geoengineering. They think that the profit motive is just magical, and if we promise to buy those instruments, they will somehow be created by our great scientific and high-tech industries.
The thing I like to remind people of is that we're running out of time and we're in a capitalist world. If you believe that there's no way to decarbonize a capitalist society, then you have to believe that we're in very, very serious trouble. But it's not clear that capital needs fossil fuels. You know, you talk about World War II and wartime mobilization. Well, wartime mobilization implies a strong state and a strong planning process. And there's no reason to believe that under the pressure of the climate emergency, we can't go back into a form of capitalism in which we do have a strong state and that is capable of imposing industrial policies and trade policies that are appropriate to a climate mobilization. There's no reason to believe that's structurally impossible. But of course, it has to be done right. And when you talk about carbon taxes or you talk about emissions trading, or you talk about any kinds of instrumentalities like that, you have to ask the question, are they going to be honest, or are they going to be just gamed by powerful economic actors like the corporations? And the good news about Glasgow is that the emissions trading rules that were finally adopted were good enough. If they are enforced, then the worst kinds of cheating that everybody was afraid of, which the Brazilians tried to ram through and basically stalled the negotiations for 3 years, those worst kinds of cheating will not be possible. There are problems with the rules that were adopted, in particular, the human rights and indigenous rights protections are absolutely not strong enough. But the worst kind of cheating are hopefully not going to be able to occur. It's a really, really good example of the fact that the administrative apparatus of the transition has to be a competent one. And the challenge is that that administrative apparatus has to be international, right? Meanwhile, we're sliding towards a global war with China. I mean, just the wrong direction. Meanwhile, there's all this pressure caused by Russian gas exports on the European economy. You know, it's going to be a wild ride for the next 10 years because the pressure is really amping up. But there's no reason to believe that in principle the situation is not manageable. It has to be done in a democratic fashion. It has to be done in a fashion that centers human rights. That makes it even more difficult, but it's still absolutely possible if we want it, if we know that we need it, if we act to get it.
Yeah, we have all the resources and all the technologies necessary.
Yes, I'm so glad to hear you say that.
My idea is that once the command economy is developed and, in fact, begins restricting the motion of the enormous range of powers that the capitalist firms have gained over the last 50 years as they took over the state in most European countries. Well, that's being challenged now. And my guess is the command economies, if they're established, if we in fact survive the climate disasters, it'll be very, very hard for the corporations to make a comeback. They may still be, in formal terms, a capitalist corporation, but there'll be very, very, very different goals and tight regulations. And ultimately, in fact, if all of that works out, there'll be so much legitimacy for that command economy that we'll see a different kind of economy that still, though, has room for entrepreneurialism of a different kind, not just for money. And it requires a huge amount of participation by ordinary people. We didn't talk about the need for energy conservation and use reduction. The less energy used, the less time it takes to build out the necessary installations and facilities for providing that energy.
That's a very interesting point, which is that if the kind of governance systems that we need are able to emerge under the pressures of the climate transition, then the structure of the economy will really change. You know, even if it remains a formally a capitalist economy, it won't be the same kind of capitalist economy that we have today. And that could buy us time. That could buy us a pathway forward, which is what we need.
Tom Athanasio, the founder of EcoEquity, attends the world conferences. He pushes for fund and technology transfers to the many developing countries and poor nations who are being affected by climate change in order to enable them to both adapt and maintain their society through water projects and the rest, as well as build up an alternative energy system and alternative transportation system, all of the things that were powered by fossil fuels that have to be enormously reconstructed. So, Tom, let's talk about those fund transfers.
the most important thing from the perspective of the finance challenge is to realize that the parts of the world that need to be very, very rapidly decarbonized and are different than the parts of the world where all the capital is concentrated. There needs to be finance and technology transfers to South Africa and to India and to Indonesia and to Southeast Asia and to parts of Latin America. And it's an immensely challenging situation because the world is not in very good shape in terms of cooperation and in terms of competent governance. But nevertheless, we have to find ways of transferring money and tech around the world very, very effectively. The pandemic has given us a really easy way of thinking about the problem. A small number of countries, notably Germany and the United States, developed a new class of vaccines. We need to transfer the right and a know-how for how to make those vaccines all around the world. And we've had tremendous problems doing that because the companies haven't wanted this transfer to occur. They would rather have a situation in which they make $1 trillion a year, $1 billion a year with the latest vaccine, which they constantly have to manufacture. It's a perfect example. We have the same situation with grid technology, storage technology, solar technology, efficiency technology, new kinds of transportation tech, new kinds of agricultural technology. A lot of know-how has to be moved around the world. And how is that going to be managed? Who knows? It's partially going to have to be private, but it's going to involve a lot of public finance. Where is that public finance going to come from? How is it going to be managed multilaterally so that it gets to the countries where it's needed? Africa needs a terrific amount of help rebuilding its energy system. Otherwise, it's just going to develop the same kind of carbon-intensive technology that we're trying to phase out in other parts of the world. How is that going to work? These are the big questions, and the climate issue forces them to the front, just like the COVID pandemic forced the question of pharmaceutical intellectual property to the front. And the things about Glasgow is this became really clear in a really new way, because one of the breakthroughs that occurred in Glasgow, I know this is going to sound ridiculous, the Glasgow Pact is the first time that an international climate treaty actually explicitly referred to fossil fuels and the need to stop investing in fossil fuels and the need to de-industrialize the fossil sector, phase it out. And once you realize that that challenge is front and center, nobody believes that it's going to happen by itself or that the routine functioning of an unregulated market is going to yield the kind of transition that we need. We've already built enough fossil technology on this planet to blow us past the point the scientists tell us we have to stop at if we want to maintain a manageable planetary climate system. We have to stop investing in fossil energy. Think about what that means. I mean, look at the business section and think about what it means to say that one of the most powerful sectors of the global economy has to be phased out, and it has to happen soon. We have to stop investing in coal and oil and gas, like now. It's kind of an amazing situation.
I think one thing that you said about, let's say, agricultural and productive systems, the new technologies are necessary. In many ways, it seems to me, indigenous people and the people who work the land for years developed systems of crop rotation and protecting the soil and, in fact, even irrigation. Now, some of them were primitive. Many of them didn't work. Famines did occur. But there's a lot of knowledge that was required, especially by small farmers in the United States as well. It's a really challenging way of making a living and necessary. The problem is that when agribusiness has sort of taken over the world, it undermined them enormously in many, many, many ways. Companies stole the water. They undersold products for a while, so small farmers could not exist. There was just so many ways. I think we have to see it as a sort of social cultural change as well as just a technological one. And I know you agree with that.
Yeah, I do.
Tom Athanasio, tell people how to access your writing and to learn more about eco-equity.
Well, I'm involved in lots of projects, but everything can be found at www.ecoequity.org. One word, ecoequity.org. That's my website.
Tom Athanasio, thanks a lot for talking to us.
Okay, thank you very much, Bill.